Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Today in the program, we speak first with Dr. David Kasaret, a physician and researcher who brings us the new book, Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. He'll chronicle his exploration of cutting-edge resuscitation, from suspended animation to cryonics, even something called crowdsourcing resuscitation.
He probably could have helped me on Saturday after the Jupiter Peak steeplechase. I needed some resuscitation.
Probably. We'll see how he does that.
I got that via a beer at 11:30 from Silver Star Cafe, so I'm in pretty good shape now. Then we're going to speak with Gretchen Reynolds. She's a blogger and author. She writes the New York Times blog Well and wrote the book The First 20 Minutes. Always condensing the most current science and translating it for the layperson, we'll look forward to talking with her about how exercise can delay Alzheimer's, why just 5 minutes a day of exercise will add to your health, and why less is more. She'll also bust on some exercise myths.
We love to talk to her. We spoke with her, a couple years ago?
I think we've talked to her twice since I've been on the show.
Always a great source of information and good at uncovering trends and deciding which are really trends and which are around for a while. So this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with Tim Henney. Our first guest, Dr. David Kasaret, became interested and, well, maybe a little obsessed with how bodies can resuscitate after hours of being dead as a doornail. Or wait, not like a doornail, because there's no resuscitation, as it turns out, for a doornail, not like there is for a dead body. Kasaret was inspired as a college student back in 1986 by a little girl, 2.5-year-old Michelle Funk, right here in Utah. I don't know if you remember this story. It was in Salt Lake City. She drowned and in icy water in the spring runoff. And after 3 hours of being quite obviously deceased, she was resuscitated and went on to live apparently a normal life. That raised big questions for Dr. Kasaret, like if you can be dead for 3 hours and revived, what about things like cryonics, flash freezing a brain and a body to be thawed at a later date? He brings up big questions about the ethics of both living and dying. He's now joining us by phone. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Dr. Kasaret.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. Your book is just fascinating. And I really like, first of all, how there is humor in it, but this is a very, very serious topic, as you describe and how you really explore the ethics of keeping people alive and, you know, going to that outer edge of maybe what we ought not to be doing.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. I did try to keep it light. There are heavy topics here. Obviously, we're talking about death and dying. And there's also a lot of science. I had to go back to some science I've forgotten since medical school about mitochondria and how metabolism works. And so to balance that, to make it readable, I really wanted to insert some fun and to try to keep it light. And so I try to do things like research the history of resuscitation. And, you know, one technique that was used back in the 18th century was throwing people over the back of a horse. So I decided to try that and wrote about it to balance some of the more heavy ethics and science topics.
Wait, you're not saying you actually tried it with a dead body?
No, I actually paid a very nice gentleman who works at a riding stable in the Philadelphia area to tie me to the back of a horse and trot the horse around a ring, because that's what resuscitation looked like 200 years ago. And I wanted to figure out how that could possibly be helpful from a first-hand experience point of view. As near as I can tell, it's not helpful at all.
I
would not recommend to anybody listening, try it.
Yeah, no good can come of that experience with a horse. You put the horse in the equation, and you've got problems right off the bat. And it's interesting that you didn't find someone to be the person that was laid across the back of the horse. I like the fact you did it yourself. And what did you learn from that, David?
I've learned, first of all, that you shouldn't do it. I've learned, second of all, that if you do something like that, you should really tell your mother that you're going to do it, because she found out about that escapade when she read that passage in the book and called me up irate, incensed that I would actually be stupid enough to try something like that without running it by my family first. So it got me in a huge amount of trouble.
So you really need to be dead if you're going to do that and then see what happens.
It certainly is probably not nearly as uncomfortable if you're dead. And frankly, if you're dead, well, what's the worst that could happen?
No.
So, yes, if you're dead, maybe it makes sense. But if you're alive, I really would not recommend it.
And that's what I like about your book. It's the information, the history of resuscitation that you delve into. Nonfiction is, you know, is wonderful, and I think you tell a great story. But what actually did you learn from riding the back of the, or being laid across the back of the horse? It must be the motion that is that's basically acting like somebody who's performing CPR on a chest, right? I mean, the chest is being compressed and then expanding, compressing and expanding, which would be opening your lungs and palpating your heart.
Right. At least that's, based on my firsthand experience, that's the only explanation I could come up with for why this mechanism was so popular 200 years ago. In reality, it probably didn't work very well. You need to get a whole lot of coordination involved, and you have to keep the person breathing if they are. There were other techniques that were used back then that are similarly both hilarious and illogical.
Can you imagine the scene that must have occurred if somebody is deceased and they're like, get the horse, get, I mean, like you say, the coordination that must have occurred, the scramble of chaos to get somebody laid across the back of a horse and then running around to try to resuscitate them, that must have been, I don't know.
A lot of coordination, but also a great spectacle. It almost makes me sad in a way that resuscitation techniques these days involve very clean-cut, organized, professional paramedics showing up, putting people on a stretcher and carting them away. Does make me think life would be a whole lot more interesting if we had horses and other techniques involved, putting people's feet in boiling water or tickling them with feathers, burying them in snow. Resuscitation would be much more of a spectator sport if we had some of those techniques still with us.
Right. Well, that great history with all of the including the professional revivers or resuscitators in Amsterdam and all of those things. But when you say burying people in snow, that makes me sort of fast forward to the brown tree frog that actually does that and dies for a period of time. And this would give scientists some belief that perhaps we could use that science and transfer it to humans.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of interest. You mentioned at the start of the interview the case of Michelle Funk, and she, as you said, was without a heartbeat, without any sign of life for 3 hours, and yet she recovered. And there are other stories like hers. And after the initial media attention dies down, people look very, very carefully at cases like that, and they try to figure out, well, what happened? What went right? Why did she survive, and why did she do so well? And one answer that's emerged from a lot of these stories from around the world has been cold, has been this idea that many of the people who survive either a near drowning or a cardiac arrest and do well seem to do well because they were either in cold water or otherwise in cold temperatures. And so even back into the 50s, there was a lot of interest in using cold to try to reduce the body's metabolism, because when you reduce metabolism, you decrease the brain, in particular's, requirement for oxygen. And so if you're using less oxygen, you could, in theory at least, survive longer and do well after a long period without a heartbeat. So a lot of the most interesting research right now is going on to try to figure out how to either reduce people's temperatures to make them cold after a cardiac arrest, or in other ways to try to trick the body into thinking it's in a state sort of like hibernation.
Right. So in the case of Michelle Funk, again, that took place in 1986. I think you said you were in college at the time and right here in Salt Lake City at a spring runoff. And so would it be fair to say that she had no brain activity for 3 hours, or is it measured just by brain activity, or just the fact that she wasn't breathing and her heart was not pumping blood for 3 hours?
Yeah, so I don't know what sort of brain activity she had. I think what everybody saw and what made everybody very, very nervous was the fact that as the clock kept ticking, she had no spontaneous heartbeat, no heart rhythm. She certainly had not woken up, and she wasn't breathing on her own. And so the concern was that as time went on, without any heartbeat, without any breathing, without any blood flow, all that time, or at least for a lot of that time, her brain in particular wasn't getting enough oxygen. She'd get CPR, obviously, for some time. She was on a breathing machine for some of that time, and even was on a bypass machine for some of that time. So it's not like she was totally without oxygen, but she was without oxygen. Her brain was without oxygen in particular for much, much longer than we like to see in a patient who's experienced a cardiac arrest. And yet she came back.
And, you know, it's funny because after reading the chapter on her, I Googled her to find out, you know, where she is now and if she has a normal life. And I really couldn't find anything, but I bet you've explored that.
I have. I had really, really hoped to meet her. I'd really hoped to tell her the story of how I heard about her story, and that her story made me want to go to medical school and become an emergency room doc in the first place, although I've changed since then. I did try to get in touch with her indirectly through her family, and after an email and a call, I didn't pursue it because I think everybody values their privacy, and I think she and her family probably had far too much media attention after this happened, and I didn't want to invade their privacy, so I didn't get a chance to speak with her. I have heard through friends of friends, knowing physicians and others in the Salt Lake community, that you know, as I can tell, she's alive and doing well. I also heard that she got married a couple of years ago, so best wishes to her and her husband. I don't know details, but for me, that's a pretty good indication that she's alive and doing well and leading a good life.
Fascinating.
So, David, currently it sounds like, and you just said that suspended animation and hibernation seems to be the focus of the current state of technology and state of the art. Is that correct? Is that where you're focusing these days? And why don't you bring us up to date with kind of the recent developments and what this looks like?
Sure. And again, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a hospice doctor, so I don't do this for a living, which made this book a lot of fun for me because I'm an educated outsider. I'm a physician, obviously, and I've done CPR and I've resuscitated patients before, but I'm really coming at it from the other side. So I've done this tour of the sciences as kind of an educated outsider, and in general, I think that the biggest opportunity that I can see out there from all the patients and researchers I've spoken with is some form of suspended animation. Although no respectable researchers I spoke with called it that, because as soon as you say suspended animation, people start thinking about science fiction and space travel. If you're a researcher trying to get funding for your work, the last thing you want anybody to say is, "Oh yeah, I saw that in a movie." That's a hard way to get credibility, but the theory is pretty sound that particularly animals out there that hibernate every winter, what they do is exactly what we would like to be able to do for patients like Michelle Funk or anybody else who suffers a cardiac arrest or soldiers injured on the battlefield. I mean, what if we could steal a couple of tricks from what bears and marmots and squirrels do every winter? And find a way to trick the body into dropping its metabolism by 99%, say. You decrease the metabolism, you decrease the oxygen requirements, and people could potentially survive much, much longer on almost no oxygen and come back, if they come back, with much, much better neurologic condition. So there's a lot of interest right now in using a variety of tricks gained from studies of squirrels and bears and lemurs. I spent some time at a lemur sanctuary in North Carolina learning about how studies of primates, because lemurs are the only primates that hibernate that we know of, how we could learn from our little lemur cousins what the secret of hibernation might be.
And David, what is the, I mean, there's a medical application that you just hit on and gave us a few examples. Is the medical field the primary application for hibernation and resuscitation, or are there other potential applications that we don't really think about very much?
Well, I think certainly the focus of the book was on medical applications, although those medical applications are pretty broad. It's not just a cardiac arrest. As I said, it's a battlefield injury for soldiers injured in the line of duty, gunshot wound victims, motor vehicle accident victims, also potentially people going through surgery. When you go into surgery, a lot of the normal parameters of heart rate and blood pressure go out the window. And your blood pressure may go up or it may go way down. There may be problems with bleeding. Those are circumstances in which you'd really want your metabolic needs to be pretty low, so your brain and your body don't care if your blood pressure drops for a few minutes. So across all those circumstances, if we could figure out how to sort of hack the hibernation gene and figure out how to reduce metabolism, people could survive in ways that they don't. Now, there are other opportunities. People are certainly thinking about space travel, particularly long voyages. Suspended animation would certainly make the trip less boring. It would certainly reduce the need to stock up on Doritos before you leave. But in terms of what people could benefit from, really potentially in the next couple of years, it's the setting of motor vehicle accidents, gunshot wounds, battlefield trauma. That's where there's huge potential to save lives.
Right. And then, so going from that, boy, we could probably talk to you for an hour about this, but, you know, you're talking about medical applications, ways to help people that are hurt or injured or ill. But let's move into this whole world of cryogenics and cryonics. And as I understand, the difference between the two words is one is the study of and one is actually performing the freezing of a body. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much correct. And when people talk about being frozen for 500 years and being revived, they talk about cryonics, and they unfortunately call themselves cryonauts, which I think is unfortunate for a lot of reasons.
Right. Well, I found maybe my most favorite sentence in your book. I love this, so I'm going to read it. You talk about going to the Alcor Life Extension Foundation, their 40th anniversary conference, which is pretty amazing that there have been 40 of them. And you're finding yourself there just to explore what, as you say, cryonauts, as they call themselves, are doing. And you say to spend a day in the company of cryonauts is to oscillate between astonished enthusiasm and incredulous skepticism in a cycle that's punctuated by sudden and uncontrollable urges to laugh hysterically.
That sounds like a really good spectator sport.
Yeah, great spectator sport. So what most surprised you, or what most, you know, was most flabbergasting, I think, of being at that foundation conference?
I think what surprised me most was the fact that there were actually some really pretty normal people there. And I say that, I mean, no disrespect to all the other cryonauts who are less normal, but there were a lot of people there who, you know, whatever you think or might think, whatever I thought about people who believe that it's possible to freeze somebody and then revive them in 1,000 years. A lot of people I met knew at some level that, you know, this is really, if not totally crazy, then at least really, really far-fetched. Like, they knew that. But as one woman I spoke with, her name was Kim Sozi, she was a young woman. She was diagnosed with a glioblastoma, a really nasty brain tumor to have, fought that diagnosis for a couple of years before she died. Decided to be cryopreserved, and I got a chance to talk with her, and she knew more about medicine and healthcare and certainly cancer treatment than many oncologists do. So she was not naive and certainly not stupid. What she told me was, yeah, I know this is one huge, big experiment, but if I'm going to be in an experiment, I'd rather be in the treatment group, meaning, yeah, I know it's a long shot. I know this is like playing the lottery, but why not? So I was really impressed by how thoughtful many people were and how much they realized that this was just a huge gamble, and they probably weren't going to come out on the other side, and they knew that, but they're willing to take a leap anyway. That both surprised me and impressed me.
And there's an aspect of furthering medical research also. It's like donating body parts, you know, being a donor mm-hmm. if you are deceased. So they're part of pushing the frontiers of medical research, which is really quite fascinating.
Yeah, I think they'd like to think so. Although, to be fair, it's not clear to me how much research is being advanced if you're being frozen. I think where the advances would happen is when people start to be thawed and we learn about what went wrong and what went right. And that's probably not going to happen for a long, long time. So everybody's entering into this weird long-term contract where they're being frozen and hoping for the best, but there's not a huge amount of rigorous research going on right now to figure out how to keep them frozen in a safe way, how to revive people. Everybody's jumping into those vats of liquid nitrogen and hoping for the best.
Okay, so that leads me to my next question. You talked about the cryonauts and there being some really amazing, wonderful, intelligent, aware people. How about the other side of the cryonaut spectrum, those folks jumping into those vats? Did you see anybody you were just like, okay, that's why it has a bad name?
Yeah, I think some of the language certainly that's used, people don't die, they deanimate, as in I deanimate, you deanimate, he, she, or it deanimates. I think it's some of that language that makes it very, very difficult to take cryonics seriously. Also, there's the fact that it seems to me that a lot of the cryonics research that's going on is not being done by respected researchers in major medical centers that are funded by the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation. There are a lot of smaller for-profit companies, people literally doing research in their own labs. And I think that makes it difficult to take the field seriously. It's hard for the field to get credibility, and frankly, it's going to be hard for the field to move forward. I mean, what moves the field forward is a lot of money, a lot of federal and private investment, and a lot of talent. That's what's moved forward things like HIV research and cancer research and genetic research, and that volume of either funding or people just isn't there. So that's part of the reason why I'm not really optimistic about the future of cryonics anytime in the near future, at least, because there just isn't that quality of science and there isn't that investment.
All very fascinating. And I'm wondering, before we let you go, David, how does this, as a palliative care doctor, a hospice care doctor, how does all of this research you've done for this book, you know, change or make your care, I don't know, just give you a different take on what you do?
Sure. It's a great question. I didn't expect there to be an answer to that question, honestly. This was sort of a sidelight to me. But as I've talked with patients, researchers, scientists, and I've begun to see how successful resuscitation can be, I've gotten sympathetic in conversations with patients and families when a patient tells me, you know, if my heart stops, yeah, try to bring me back. And even though that patient may have metastatic cancer and other medical problems, and I really don't think that's in her best interest, and I would tell her that, I would always respect her choice, obviously. But I'm more sympathetic to that idea that comes up in many of my patients and their families that, you know, like, if you think you could bring me back, try it. It just seems so easy. It's not, but I see where they're coming from in a way that I didn't a year ago, and so my conversations now I think are better and more nuanced and hopefully more helpful to patients and families.
Our guest is Dr. David Kasaret, and I hope I approximated the pronunciation of your last name. Is that close?
It's close oh. enough.
Okay. The book is Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, and it is really a fascinating subject and a very well-done book. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye. And again, Dr. David Kasaret, if you're interested in looking up that book, it's with a C, C-A-S-A-R-E-T-T. And the book is Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with Gretchen Reynolds. She's the author and blogger of the New York Times column, or blog, I should say. Well, lots of interesting information from her. We'll be right back. This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
What would life in Park City be like without KPCW? Who would immediately report news and issues important to our area? KPCW is launching the Broadcasters Club, a major giving initiative for donors who are committed to securing a future for local radio. Broadcasters Club members commit to an annual financial contribution. Benefits include on-air recognition, exclusive outings, events, and more. For more information on how you can invest in your community radio, please call Cindy at 435-513-2929.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Summer is here at Utah Olympic Park. Olympic-sized adventure awaits you on the zip lines, alpine slide, adventure ropes courses, and the always popular Summer Comet bobsled ride. Don't miss the Flying Ace All-Stars freestyle show every Sunday at 1 p.m. The park is open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. with activities available beginning at 10 a.m. For activity tickets, season passes, and more information, go to UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, Gretchen Reynolds, our next guest, is the blogger behind the popular New York Times blog called Well. She's also a prolific writer for publications like Outside Magazine, Runner's World, Bicycling, and Oprah Magazine. She also wrote the book, The First 20 Minutes, always condensing the most current science and translating and deciphering it for the layperson. We look forward to talking to her about how, well, things like how exercise can delay Alzheimer's, why just 5 minutes a day of exercise will up your health, and why less is sometimes more. She'll also bust on some exercise myths she's found along the way. Gretchen Reynolds, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, we liked it so much when we spoke to you. I don't even remember when it was when your book, The First 20 Minutes, came out. It was fascinating.
Well, thank you. I certainly find it really interesting.
Right. And so talk to us first about what it is you do. I know that in your blog, Well, you take science and you kind of gather it here and there, and then you come up with, you know, you coalesce some of the information and then present it in an interesting way. Would that be fair to say?
Well, the interesting is your word.
Right.
My column in particular is focused on sort of the very, very broad topic of exercise science, which really encompasses anything that has to do with the body. So that's a lot of science. That's everything from neuroscience to looking at disease risk to looking at how little exercise you can get away with and still be healthy, to do all sorts of topics about how, in effect, our bodies can be as healthy and productive as possible. So it's very interesting in my personal life also.
Right. As someone who pursues fitness quite regularly, right?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I spend more time writing about exercise than doing it, which is why I'm always encouraged by the study showing how little you can get away with.
Right, exactly. So this is my first question, really. I mean, it used to be that it was long, slow, aerobic. Now the trend, as you say in one of your blogs, is that, you know, less is more, and your blog called the 7-minute workout. I think we love that. We talked about that a couple of times, and as you say, as the science shows, I always love when science backs up something that supports what I want to do, which is maybe exercise less and get more bang for my buck.
Well, I do think there has been a real focus among physiologists in the last few years on truly how little exercise is beneficial. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is that people were not exercising long, slow periods of time. They just were not. I mean, some people might, but very few people were going out and jogging for a couple of hours or walking for a couple of hours or doing anything for a couple of hours. The statistics were very clear that most people, the majority of Americans, were not being physically active at all. So I think one of the motivating principles behind some of this research was to find out how little exercise people could do and get really significant health benefits in hopes that that might inspire people to exercise.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think a lot of researchers were very interested in whether there are particularly unique benefits to doing a short, more intense workout.
That brings to mind CrossFit. Did CrossFit evolve out of kind of what's been discovered recently and how science is pushing this new frontier of less is more?
Yes, to an extent. I think CrossFit has their own pseudoscience to some degree, but a fair amount of CrossFit is based on this idea that you can get tremendous physical benefits from a short amount of exercise if it's reasonably intense. And that's a very, very individualized concept. I mean, what is intense for someone who's been sitting on the couch for 20 years, who has not done any exercise, is going to be really different than an intense session for someone who used to run marathons. So that's one important concept about all of this, is that when you hear the word, you know, intense exercise, remember that is relative to you right now. It basically means if you can go out and walk as fast as you can for 1 minute and then go a little easier for a minute, then walk as fast as you can for another minute, that is an intense exercise for you. And that is really beneficial. If you do that for 5 minutes, that is going to have an impact on every bodily system that you have.
And Gretchen, I remember from some of our previous conversations, one of the things that you always hit on and bring into the conversation is that sitting is one of the worst things that we can possibly do, and we need to break up our day of sitting with these little periods of short exercise. They aren't even intense. It's just basically movement.
And it's even just standing up.
And I always wonder about, as you just said, that person, the one that you used in the example of CrossFit, who's been on the couch for 20 years, I'm kind of amazed when I see people who do sit. They have a very sedentary life. They don't exercise, and yet they seem quite healthy, and they live into, you know, they live long lives. I wonder about that. Are they healthy, or are they just lucky?
Probably genetically lucky, and also probably not as sedentary as you think. A lot of people who actually don't necessarily, quote-unquote, exercise do get quite a bit of what scientists call light-intensity activity, meaning that they're walking around a lot. They may be cooking. They may be cleaning their house, which other people actually don't do. That the amount of light-intensity activity that most of us do has fallen off a cliff, basically. Our parents and grandparents used to just stand up, move around so much more than we do. And sitting, as you mentioned, is actually so unhealthy. It's bad for your heart. It's bad for your brain. It's bad for your waistline. And what's really interesting is that's true even if you do go out and exercise for 15, 20 minutes. If you then come back and sit the entire rest of the day, you pretty much undo the benefits of exercise. You really, for ideal health, for the best health that you can get, it's important to try to do some formal exercise of some kind and sit less.
Right. So it is good, the fact that at the radio station here, which is in Old Town Park City, there's, you know, my favorite coffee haunt is just like 50 yards away. And I get up from time to time and run down there. And, well, I don't run. I trot, maybe.
But that's so interesting.
No, that's
because
perfect.
That's a great point, because, you know, I'm thinking about in urban settings, people walk, and they walk long distances, and they view that as normal. You know, they'll walk 20 blocks, and it'll take a half an hour, and that is considered normal. And here in Park City, where we're a very active community and we do a lot of exercising, not many people would consider walking for a half an hour to get from a neighborhood to Old Town. They jump in their car and they drive. Mm-hmm. Now, they may do a little walking when they're in Old Town, but that's a really kind of interesting shift on or perspective on the whole thing. We're in an active community with less walking. You have these urban communities where walking is normal.
It's actually very interesting, and it is an extension of some really interesting research that was done recently into sitting patterns of healthy professionals, and they looked at, they actually had the people wear shorts, wear underwear, basically, that could test or know how much their upper leg muscles were contracting throughout the day. And they found that the people were actually less active. They did less just basic everyday walking, that sort of thing, on the days when they exercised. They actually were more sedentary overall on the days when they, quote-unquote, got a workout. Because apparently, subconsciously, they thought, okay, now I've done something. I can sit the entire rest of the day. So if they were going to the restaurant, they got in their car to drive. If they were needed lunch, they sent out for it. All those things basically added up to their being more sedentary, using less energy, meaning more calories. They used less calories on the days when they worked out than the days when they didn't.
The only problem,
we have sort of lost the idea that we should just walk places.
Right.
The only problem with that study, I couldn't do it because I'd have to wear underwear.
TMI, too much information. But it is funny that you say that, Gretchen, because my first thought was, you know, how everyone had a heart rate monitor, and then, you know, everyone had a GPS to monitor how many feet. And
now
then,
everybody Stravas.
And everyone Stravas, and people have pedometers, and now are everyone going to wear those underwear that measure how sedentary you are?
Not me.
They will be for sale in the not-too-distant future, actually.
That is so very interesting. And, Gretchen, I have to tell you, as I'm watching my co-host across the desk here in the live studio, he is remembering and recalling more of our conversation with you, because as of about 10 minutes ago, he's been doing air squats and standing, and pretty soon he'll be doing push-ups. But it's all very interesting. He's also wearing this T-shirt that shows that he did the Jupiter Peak Steeplechase Race, which is an annual race here in Park City. You go from the base of Park City Mountain Resort to the very tip top, the highest peak, which is at about 10,000 feet, and then you run back down. So it's about 15 miles. It's this really gnarly thing. Now, that is an endurance event. And so I want to ask you, one of your recent blogs is about exercise and weight loss. Not that Tim was trying to lose weight, but the difference between endurance and this high intensity when you're looking at things like weight loss, and also, you know, what's best for you?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and that's getting a lot of attention scientifically, and I think just in our general culture right now, because by and large, and lots of people will bear this out, when people start an endurance program, not if they've been doing it for a long time, but if they start an endurance program, say they're training for a marathon, a lot of people gain weight. It doesn't seem to matter how much they run. Particularly when you start some kind of endurance training, most people will see an increase in their appetite. Endurance exercise does prompt the body to release more appetite hormones. That the body does think you're essentially starving. You are using more energy than your body is used to you using. This is more true for women than men, and that seems to be from an evolutionary standpoint, because our bodies want to make sure we could provide nutrients for babies. A lot of people who are doing marathon training complain that they're getting heavier.
Mm-hmm.
The upshot of that is you have to be honest with yourself and not take in more calories than you have just burned. A half-hour jog does not use that many calories. A bottle or two of Gatorade will almost replace all of them.
Yeah.
So you have to be honest about that. What is interesting is there is some emerging research showing that intense exercise, short, intense, sort of interval-type exercise, tends to suppress appetite instead of mm-hmm. increasing it. And that may not last, you know, forever, but it does appear that for most people, intense exercise will reduce your appetite. That can last into the next day. People usually are not as hungry, that they don't want to eat as much. And there is some research also that centers in the brain that are related to appetite become less active after intense exercise as opposed to longer, slower exercise. So if you want to use it for weight loss, want to use exercise, intense exercise might be a good idea, but you're also not going to burn as many calories overall.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Gretchen Reynolds. She's a blogger behind the popular New York Times blog called Well. Gretchen, so that whole fat-burning thing of low-intensity exercise, has that belief sort of gone away, or is it's still there? We just think that maybe it increases our appetite, so we eat more, and the sum total is that, well, we don't really lose weight.
Well, and minute for minute, if for instance, you have 30 minutes and you go for a walk, you are actually at a lower intensity. You do tend to burn somewhat more body fat, but you burn fewer calories overall than if in that same 30 minutes you run or you do something more intense. So you're going to use more calories or burn more calories. So, you know, some of it is basic math. How many calories are you burning and how many are you taking in? You know, by and large, exercise by itself is not proven to be very good at weight loss. You absolutely have to also control your diet, watch your calories, be honest with yourself. I mean, some of that's just common sense. What is really interesting is once you have lost some weight, exercise is really, really good at helping you to keep it off. It does seem to help the brain reset its sense of how much you should weigh. And so there's not nearly as much pull once you've lost some weight to regain it if you exercise. And that's in any way, whether it's intense or easy. If you are moving, people are much less likely to regain weight.
Gretchen, I know that recently I've been reading a lot of information, and this fits right into the exercise and the calories in, calories out discussion, but Dr. Hyman has been presenting a lot of information about it's the type of calories that we put in, it's the type of food that we eat, which helps to determine how hungry we're going to be, which sort of calories our body burns, and how we reset on that calorie in, calorie out scale. So. I just imagine that you're running across that a great deal also, that it's the types of food that we refuel with or fuel with from the beginning.
Yes, there certainly is some evidence that what kind of calories you eat and the extent to which they contain certain sugars does have an impact. Although it is interesting that the more exercise you're getting, the less the type of calories that you're taking in matter. Fundamentally, if you are exercising, you know, somewhat frequently or you're exercising intensely, you do tend to burn both fat and carbohydrates, meaning sugars, pretty well. And it doesn't seem to matter as much as it does for sedentary people. So that's another, you know, really important reason to exercise is it basically helps you to maintain even if your diet is not ideal.
Gretchen, I fit right into that pattern that you described because since the Jupiter Peak Steeplechase run on Saturday. I have done absolutely nothing until I started doing air squats during our interview. So I fit right into that big exercise and then nothing at all for a few days. I like to chalk it up to recovery, but I'm not sure I can use that excuse anymore. I wanted to ask you about one of your recent blogs, though. It's fascinating to me. It's how our arms help us run, because when running, I tend to focus on my arm position and how I use my arms, and I play with that a lot. I'm very conscious and aware of it, and I see that it has a significant difference on my stride and kind of my exertion level in some of these trail runs that I do.
Which is interesting, because the study that I wrote about actually found that how you hold your arms doesn't really matter in terms of sort of the broad picture for a lot of people. It certainly will make some difference when you're going up and down hills. What the researchers found was that arms, if you move them at all, and if you don't just hold them behind your back or hold them on top of your head or some rather ridiculous form, that they actually will make running easier. They make you more efficient. But how you hold your arms, whether you're holding them sort of further out to your side, whether you're crossing them in front of your chest, did not seem to have a very big impact on people's efficiency, which is actually good news. I mean, it's great to focus on your arms because it can help you to not think about how unpleasant the running uphill might be. But it does not mean that people have to hold their arms in one certain way, that there is a certain form that is ideal.
And was there kind of a placebo effect like the one I just described? Because I perceive there being a difference, and was it determined that it's a perceived difference, and does that affect the way people run?
It may well be a placebo effect. It also, in individual cases, almost certainly does have some impact. One thing that is very important is if you are focusing on your arms and you are not thinking about the exertion, you probably can go harder. So in that case, how you think about your arms, how you move your arms, does have an effect on your form. But as you said, it may be more placebo than anything else. I mean, the researchers who were at the University of Colorado in Boulder, they're used to people running mountains, running hills, found that the volunteers had really different patterns of holding their arms. Some were doing it in sort of the classic cross a little bit above your, around, in front of your chest, close to your body, and others, they were way out to the side or, you know, sort of flopping all around. What mattered was that they were using their arms, but not how they were using them. So if you have a really eccentric way of holding your arms, it's probably fine. If you want to experiment with other ways as you're running, it may help you run by distracting you from how unpleasant the hard running is.
I'll go with that. Gretchen, I'm wondering, we'll switch into biking here. Right now is day 3 of the Tour of Utah. It's sort of the longest stage race, professional stage race in the country. And a lot of the, well, maybe 8 or so of the cyclists have come off of just having completed the Tour de France. Now, apparently, it takes them just 5 or 6 days to recover. Now, they're all about, what, mid-20s, 30, you know, maybe 35 at the oldest. I'm wondering about recovery. I just find that fascinating. Sometimes it seems like it takes me, you know, from a huge event like the Tour de France, it would take me a year to recover. What's the current science on recovery and as you age specifically?
It takes longer to recover as you age. That scientists are definitely looking into that because many of them are aging athletes.
Right.
The issue of recovery basically means two things. One is recovering specifically from sore muscles. If you've just done a run like you did, Tim, you probably have sore muscles, especially from running downhill, which causes eccentric contractions. That's a type of contraction where the muscle actually lengthens as it contracts. So if you're going downhill, your leg muscles are lengthening as you hit the ground. That causes more damage to the muscles, and it does take longer to recover from that. than from, say, even running uphill or running on flat. So that's the first part of recovery, is you actually have to let the muscles start to heal the little bitty tears that you've made, which they will heal, be stronger. That's the whole sort of pain and gain aspect of training. There's almost no way to speed that except to basically take off a little bit and maybe move some, go for a walk. But you can't, there's no evidence that ice baths help. There's no evidence at all that things like ibuprofen help. In fact, they slow the healing.
Really?
Yes, yeah. Ibuprofen is a real problem for athletes because it actually does, it doesn't make you any less sore, but it takes longer than for the muscles to actually heal. So ibuprofen is not a good idea for people who are seriously training.
What about the anti-inflammatory properties of
ibuprofen? It actually seems to increase inflammation. People who take ibuprofen wind up with more inflamed muscles than those who don't.
Wow.
There is no good reason scientifically to use ibuprofen, and unless you have an actual injury. If you have, say, you've turned your ankle, if you have an acute injury.
Right.
But for the recovery from the, you know, hard workout, there's no evidence that it helps. There's pretty good evidence that it harms.
Wow.
Then there's the broader issue of sort of helping your whole body to recover, which is what you're talking about from the Tour de France. And I'm honestly not quite sure how they can have recovered yet and whether they've fully recovered yet, because the body does take a while to recover from at least a hard workout. It does not take it very long to recover from the workouts that you're used to. If you're used to running for 3 or 4 miles, you're going to be able to run 3 or 4 miles the next day. Even at my advanced age, I can do that. It's a good idea to make sure that your nutrition is adequate, and that means if you have done a fairly strenuous workout of any kind, even if it's short but intense, you do need to replace some of the energy that you've used. That's even if you're trying to lose weight. You want to make sure that you replace some of the carbohydrates that your muscles have used. And you can do that with, I think I may have mentioned this on our last time, chocolate milk is a really good and proven recovery beverage. Because if you've worked out for at least half an hour, you will have used quite a bit of the stores of energy in your muscles, and you will have caused a little bit of muscle damage. So you want some carbohydrates and some protein to replenish the muscles. Chocolate milk seems to have a scientifically ideal ratio of carbohydrates to protein. It really is a very good recovery beverage and does help people to safely exercise again the next day.
Wow, that's interesting. There's science behind chocolate milk. Well, very good. Well, Gretchen Reynolds, unfortunately, we're out of time. It's been so great to have you on again today. And Gretchen is the blogger of the blog Well of the New York Times. And any new projects quickly?
Well, actually, we're going to be, here at the Times, we're going to be doing an update of the scientific 7-minute workout.
Oh, great.
Within the next couple months, so watch for that.
Okay, wonderful. We love that one. All right, Gretchen, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Gretchen Williams of the New York Times blog. Gretchen Reynolds. I only said it 4 or 5 times. She is the blogger of Well, the New York Times blog. Very great information on that blog. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Kevin Stocking, president of Heber Valley Bank. We offer a full spectrum of loans for lots, construction, HELOCs, commercial, and personal needs. Our loan decisions are made locally. Heber Valley Bank is a proud supporter of KPCW. We are located in Heber City and Midway and at Grand Valley Bank in Park City. HeberValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And here are our underwriters, Park City Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, and Vinto Pizzeria.
This is KPCW Park City.